From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I am quite enjoying saying yeah, yeah, ding dong for whatever reason this morning, but there you are.
There's something he can do that other people can't, and he offers it to other people. And that's what kind people do.
I had more neurological effects, actually, funny enough. Falling over, fainting, hallucinating, that kind of thing.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, the absolute last person you want to take the mic at your wedding. When will I be vaccinated? And the bear man of Buncrana yearning to be free. That's all on the way over the next hour. Of the radio catch-up service, most wedding guests are likely to end up shifting as the band plays New York, New York. Back when there were weddings, that is. Let's start this Playback Daily with Ryan Tuberty's musings on this morning's news. The newsings, if you will. And this gem of a wedding scene.
Much talk about weddings. I was doing a few clips for people for video clips for a wedding and birthdays and things like that yesterday. And I was wondering about the wedding, the COVID wedding, and how's that working out for everybody? And I suspect that there is a value to intimacy in having small numbers. I think you might have a better, more interesting wedding an intimate wedding than you might have had with 150 people chased around the place and your nerves gone and not really getting to see anyone properly. I have no idea. But I do know that some weddings have been destroyed by the arrival of the drunkle. The drunk uncle who decides I'm going to get involved here, and it might just be to say a few words that weren't on the agenda, and it might be to sing a song. And unfortunately, drunkles very often don't realise that. And actually, no, I'm not going to just blame the uncles. There are some people at a wedding who don't realise that your song that you choose to sing when everyone's kind of half gone to bed, or the sing song at the end, was often the best bit. Don't sing a song that with 55 verses. Please, I beg you, don't do that. Because maybe it's a song, it's a history song, and it goes on, and then they all died. And how many of them died? Well, the first fella died, then the second fella, and their names, and their family, the village they came from, and the headland they came from, and all the people who mourned them came from them. And you say, how many of them? 32 was a mining accident. Oh, for God, they were in for the mine. And just pick a nice, like, it's because you are essentially the wedding party equivalent of a modern American podcast. You simply don't know when to end, and you're not as interesting as you think you are, and it was fine for the first two episodes. That's just a passing thought. So imagine the couple who say, we're going to spend $5 bazillion and get married in Mar-a-Lago, or whatever, the Mar-a-Lago, the Trump White House on tour. When who walks in with a podcast sing-song session to say a few hellos on the microphone? None other than...
You know, I just got the news. I get all these flash reports, and they're telling me about the border.
Now, bear in mind, the couple are sitting down, yeah, this is nice, but here's the press. This could be fun.
Well, they were ready to make it. Yeah, they would have done anything. And this guy goes and drops the sanctions, and then he says, we want to negotiate.
So he's... not only not talking about the bride and groom, not only talking about their happiness or life, broadly speaking, he's talking about losing the election and the coverage he's getting in.
You saw what happened a few days ago. It was terrible. And the border's not good. The border's the worst anybody's ever seen it.
It is like the worst stand-up routine you ever saw at a wedding. And it was probably great crack for the first 10 minutes, getting the pictures out, and still... handshake.
And the talk is... in the most humanitarian way.
Now, the couple are looking at each other going, hang on a second. Did anyone hire this guy? And if so, can we get rid of him?
Nobody has ever seen anybody. There's never been anything like what's... And you're going to have hundreds, and you have it now. They have the airplane photos, the shops.
Now you can't even go to the bar because he'd probably call you out. And you're thinking, well, how long is he going to stay here for? I don't know. Does anyone know anyone who could maybe call a bouncer?
Look, it's a disaster. It's a humanitarian disaster from their standpoint.
I could be here pretty much all morning. He just wouldn't stop railing against Joe Biden, the election results, the border. Amazing. That was at the hotel, at the golf resort, the family and the weddings party looking up going, wow, amazing, amazing.
Not the word I would have chosen, but okay. Now from horror weddings to horror shoppings.
And meanwhile, we've often talked with admiration about the elegant raven and the way he might or she might look at you. And the ravens in a certain part of America, in Alaska, have become so smart and so Hitchcockian in their endeavours that shoppers now need to make a run from the supermarket to the car with their bags, because the ravens know what's in the bag. They know what to target, when to target, and how to target it. That's how bright these guys are. One guy was packing his groceries into his car in the parking lot. The raven swooped in and took a short rib from his cart, I should say, this trolley. And he said, the guy said, I took 10 steps away, turned around, two ravens came down and instantly grabbed one of it out of the package, ripped it off, flew off. And the piece of meat was about 4 by 7 inches. Sizable meal for a sizable bird. They knew what they were doing. It's not the first time. They're very fat around here. So I think the whole system, they have it sussed. Other sightings have emerged. One said, my parents were minding their business after a shop, made it home, but one less steak. The bird snatched it right out of the pack in the parking lot. The ravens have been described as, they're like calculating. She said ravens hovered around her in an attempt to steal her groceries. I had two of them. One that was on the car next to me, and he kept squawking really loudly. And he'd sit on the car and stare at me, and then hop next to the bed of the truck on the other side, and he kept going back and forth. And the other raven was on the ground, and he kept trying to pull. And I had these little melons, and you have them in these mesh bags, and he kept trying to grab the netting and pull the melon out of the trolley. And a raven started to fly in a circle around this person until she got them to beat it, basically. And he was waiting for another opportunity to grab them. And you get it. They're smart. Tread carefully, you never know.
Hitchcock as street theatre, but in real life. Makes the seagulls here on the East Coast seem like kittens. Huge, angry, flying kittens, but you see what I'm getting at. Anyway, finally for Tuesday's musings, yes, I'm sticking with it, we'll circle back to our first topic, and a listener, an uncle, and a drinker, all the same person, you see, got onto the show to have their say about drunkles.
On behalf of the drunken uncles throughout the land, we refuse to be linked with Donald Trump. He doesn't drink, so he's automatically excluded. But even more importantly, he interrupted before the traditional drunkle arrives at drunkenness. We are generally sober until about an hour after the formal part of the wedding. Yours respectfully, from the Honourable Society of Drunken Uncles. I appreciate that text and the sentiment with which you wrote it, because I wouldn't like to do a bad drunkle down. It just simply wouldn't be fair.
A suitably respectful way to end the musings, hello, from this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. After 11 months of cocooning, Dominic Rowley, consultant in sexual health and HIV medicine in Midlands Regional Hospital, contracted COVID-19 6 weeks ago. Although he's now out of hospital, he's still feeling some serious effects of the virus, and as a medical professional, he wants to let people know just how debilitating COVID can be. He spoke this morning to Claire Byrne.
You noticed symptoms about 6 weeks ago, was it?
Yeah, I was lucky to get to 11 months after isolation. But it came on, like, I think pretty much the same as everybody else, like kind of like a sledgehammer. Mine weren't respiratory. I was only coughing very mildly. And that's the kind of the danger. That's what, you know, originally in Italy, they said was the danger zone. People not recognizing that their respiratory disease is so bad. I had more neurological effects, actually, funny enough, falling over, fainting, hallucinating, that kind of thing, refusing ambulances to go to hospital.
Right, because we haven't heard much about that, about the neurological symptoms.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, and I thought I was going mad, because you're delirious as well with the high fever, you know. And I look back on the first ambulance that came, and I had to sign a disclaimer saying, listen, lads, no, I'm fine, I'm perfectly fine. And they were like, no, you're very ill. Second day, the ambulance called, and I did take it.
You were saying you were fainting and you were delirious. Can you explain to us what you remember?
My hallucination, it kind of went on for about from Wednesday to Saturday until I got admitted. Hallucinations were the main problem. I had to keep all the lights on. The house very bright because the dark was making the hallucinations worse. I had an interesting Chinese woman beside me for the whole 3 days of hallucinating. Fell over everything, really, that she could fall over. Bins, chairs, everything.
It's been quite scary, was it?
Yeah, it was quite scary. But I suppose the only saving grace was the lack of awareness, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you, Dominic, you have something called common variable immune deficiency.
Yeah, it's the most common immune deficiency in adults. And ironically, the whole world knows about antibodies now, but we don't produce antibodies, well, enough antibodies. That's the kind of the double irony. So that's the reason I had to cocoon, first of all. And the cocooning happened overnight, literally a letter, an email from my consultant saying, now you stop all face-to-face work, close your practice, no public transport, no shops, literally overnight. And that was about a week before Leo's speech. So, you know, it was really, really profoundly shocking. But that is the underlying reason why I got so sick and was hospitalized.
Right, because for you it's particularly dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the gov.ie, you know, labeled us as extremely medically vulnerable. Now, they've just changed the label because it wasn't a very nice label. But, extremely medically vulnerable. Mm-hmm.
So what happened then when you went to hospital, Dominic?
Well, when I went to hospital, as I said, I didn't think I had respiratory, the classic thing. So obviously when I got to hospital, it's a bit of a blur. I mean, I was obviously confused and delirious and muddled. But I do remember the docs in James's, in the isolation, COVID isolation ward, discussing, you know, will we bring him to HDU? Will we bring him to ICU? And I had the medical hat on me enough to know how scary that was. So they put me in the prone position and all the drips in, obviously, and on high dose oxygen. And the prone position, well, I mean, I have such admiration for people who did prone position for days and weeks. I mean, I could only last 6 hours in the prone position. It's quite traumatic, you know.
Because you're face down, right?
But it's not like a massage table where, you're hanging over the edge of the table and then of the bed, and then nurses are on their knees injecting you upside down and asking you if you're okay. And it's one of the reasons why there's going to be a mental health tsunami coming down the road for patients, healthcare staff, everybody. And then I just said to the doctors, I said, look, guys, I can't do this. I'd rather go to ICU and be sedated. I can't do this.
Is it because it was uncomfortable or was it painful?
I have such a long medical history. It wasn't painful. It was so unbelievably frightening and isolating to be looking down and have a nurse on her knees looking up at you. The whole situation is it's different to any disease. Don't know the disease, you have to do that.
Because it's interesting, because you said earlier that you only had a mild cough and yet you were put in the prone position to relieve pressure on your lungs. So you must have had quite an impact on your respiratory system at that stage.
Yeah, no, I went straight for a CT scan, which, you know, I kind of wasn't semi-aware of. And unbelievably, both lungs from top to bottom were white out, complete pneumonia in both lungs from top to bottom. And so I was that classic case of people falling off the cliff with COVID and just not realizing how ill they are and then unfortunately passing away.
So you went from zero to seriously ill pretty quickly, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So you were in the COVID ward in St. James's. Can you remember the other people who were there with you? Were you aware of the other people there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was really fortunate that I responded to the steroids and the remdesivir the antiviral drug. I was on a huge amount of oxygen, but we were in a 4-bed ward and the other men were older than me, but, you know, you become pals and, you know, you're helping people answer mobiles and getting to the toilet. But over the course of the 15, 16 days, we were locked in the ward. So you couldn't even go down the corridor. So that alone was surreal. But then nearly every night there'd be a crash call and one of my friends or, you know, bedfellows would drop their oxygen levels and be rushed to ICU. And then the next morning I would ask the nurses, how did Paddy get on? And Paddy had died. So five of my friends / bedfellows passed away when I was in there for the 3 weeks.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinarily awful.
Really upsetting, I'm sure. For you, so you said you were in there for how long?
About 16 days in the locked ward, and then I got out to a ward that I could walk around in.
And how have you been then since you left hospital?
Well, I mean, I like you can imagine, I was singing and dancing leaving hospital, you know, just ecstatic. And this is, I suppose, this is the thing that I suppose so important for your listeners to hear this. I mean, I pretty much have got worse every day since I left, which, you know, given my medical history, that wouldn't be typical. You know, normally you know yourself, if you have an operation or anything, you have a bad day, then a good day, and you get eventually stronger. But I'm increasingly breathless, and then the memory and the COVID fog is hard to that's a hard one to get your head around.
And you've been back to hospital a couple of times since you were discharged.
Yeah, a few times the oxygen levels dropping. I think the cognitive thing is very difficult to kind of, I suppose, cope with or to get your head around.
So that's I mean, you would characterize that, would you, as brain fog, what you're experiencing at the moment?
I'm hoping it's brain fog. People keep on asking me about long COVID, and I don't think it's very helpful because nobody knows when, what date or time long COVID kicks in. And I'm going to the COVID clinic in James's next Friday, and I'm assuming this is early stages side effects of COVID, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you're concerned then about long COVID, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I wouldn't be a big Googler of my medical conditions, but I have very bold this week, I'm Googling away. But long COVID really just is an extension of these current feelings, you know, extreme fatigue, not being able to walk, not being able to breathe, and fog.
Mm-hmm. But it's not long. I mean, you were very seriously ill not that long ago.
True. In terms of...
It just may take time.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I suppose, you know, we're all the same. There's frustration. I mean, there's a frustration about all of our situation. You know, we're all fatigued by life. And I suppose it is hard to keep the mental health up.
Mm, but given what you've been through, Dominic, your message today is to remind people what this can do to somebody like you, otherwise healthy. I know you had your underlying condition to deal with, but living a very healthy life, and this has left you in a really difficult place.
Yeah, and I'm not that young anymore, but I'm a youngish man, and it really, I know April the 5th and we're all dreading what's going to happen, but it really is the most vicious virus, and like, please keep going, and please just avoid each other, because it really isn't worth it.
Crikey. That's Dominic Rowley, consultant in sexual health and HIV medicine in Midlands Regional Hospital, telling Claire Byrne about his terrifying and ongoing experience of contracting COVID-19. This afternoon's Live Line kicked off with a look at the Jabs for the Boys affair, as it's now being called, with the private hospital The Beacon giving COVID-19 vaccines to the private school St Gerard's. A teacher from St Gerard's wrote to the programme, and Joe Duffy read out their letter.
The private hospital, The Beacon, giving the vaccines to the private school, St Gerard's, has been the total silence from the school, St Gerard's, either from the staff, the principal, the board of management, pupils, past pupils, parents of pupils, absolute total silence. So when we got this letter, one, we verified it with a series of long phone calls with the person who sent the letter, and that we are satisfied that person is a member of the staff of St Gerard's School in Bray, and the ethos in the school, I'll read it out to you in a sec. It says, our school is a community with students from a wide variety of backgrounds, cultures and religion, united by a common aim, the formation of young adults able to participate fully in the academic, social, cultural and economic life of the greater community. As a Catholic school, we accompany students on their spiritual journey and emphasise charity, honesty, integrity and reflection. This is the letter from the staff member in St Gerard's. Dear Joe, I'm writing to you in relation to the St Gerard's / Beacon Hospital scandal, which broke last Friday. I am a teacher in St Gerard's Senior School, and I am utterly devastated and very angry by what has taken place. I just want to make the point that this is not all the teachers in St Gerard's. It is a very small minority of them, and they have to live with this. The vast majority had no part in this, and yet are being tarred with the one brush. The number of teachers and management who took this vaccine is 20. There are approximately 100 members of staff between the two schools, so approximately a fifth are involved in this affair. The chosen colleagues never told or shared this information with the rest of us. The rest of the teaching body and staff only learned of this appalling affair from the breaking news on Friday morning. Teachers and their extended family and staff are innocent of this scandal, have had to endure text messages and phone calls all weekend asking them if they had skipped the queue and taken the vaccine. We should not be expected to carry the can for them. I do not accept these vaccines were going to waste, etc. And I can swear I would not have taken the vaccine had I been offered it. I am fit and healthy, and I'm frustrated that my own elderly relatives have not yet been vaccinated. I am glad I did not get the call anyway, as I would have been left knowing that this was going on, and then I too would have been complicit. It is a disgrace. It should never have happened. And that's from a teacher in the senior school in St. Gerard's. And as I say, we verified that that person is a bona fide teacher in the school, and who they say they are.
The Jabs for the Boys affair involving the Beacon Private Hospital, St. Gerard's Private School in Bray, and some leftover COVID-19 vaccines. Happy birthday, Ross O'Keeney.
Big day today?
Yeah, big day.
Tell me what it is.
17th birthday today.
Congratulations.
Ross from Donegal Town was watching last Friday's Late Late Show, which raised a huge sum for the Irish Cancer Society, and Ross's mum was watching with him.
So me and mum were just down watching the Late Late Show, and I just came up with the idea to start a fundraiser for the Irish Cancer Society, and I started it, and kicked off from there, basically.
And was it, when you were watching the show, was the show heavy going for you, or did you find yourself
No, the show was good, yeah. We could relate to a lot of it from all the stories and all the people that are on. We found it great.
And tell me about your story and your relationship to the story.
Well, at the start of January, my dad passed away from cancer, and then a couple of days later, my granddad passed away from cancer as well. Okay. So, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. And January, what are we on now? It's only March, so that's very recent. How are you doing? You okay?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Yeah, lots of support from people around me. So, yeah, I'm doing good.
Okay. What does lots of support mean, Ross? What are people doing?
They're just being there for you when you need them and just there to talk to. And they're good.
They're being good for you. And how's your mum doing?
Yeah, mum's doing good. Yeah, she's fine. Yeah.
Okay, good on her. So you were watching the show and you decided to do something. What did you do?
I started a fundraiser for the Irish Cancer Society.
And how much did you set your goal for, your initial goal, target?
Initially, I was going to put €150, but then Mum shreds or just put up to 200 and see how you do. And I'm at 18 grand now.
So you thought maybe 200. Your mother was a little more ambitious and said go a bit higher. So yeah. When you went to bed on Friday, how much had you got on, how much had you raised?
About 1.5 grand.
1,500. And then you woke up on Saturday and it was what?
Close to €5,000.
And today is Tuesday and it's at how much?
€18,900.
So just shy of €20,000. That is remarkable. Yeah. What happened? I mean, why were you thinking just €200, which is a lot of money, but why were you thinking that?
I didn't really think I would raise so much, to be honest. I didn't really expect this at all.
Yeah, sure. And why do you think people responded so generously?
I just thought it was a really good cause and that I just gave them a platform to donate and they took advantage of it and now we're flying.
Ryan asked Ross to put his unsuspecting mum on the phone.
That is such a gorgeous thing that Ross did.
Yeah, it was pretty much himself. Like, you know, we hadn't discussed it previously. So, yeah, well, you see, we've experienced, obviously, a lot of support and help from the Irish Cancer Society with Dad and with Granddad and other family members, you know. So, it would be a charity that would be very close to our hearts here in this family, you know. So, Ross did really well. And it's the generosity of all the people in the public and everybody that liked and shared the post that made it as it is, you know, today. So, yeah, we're very happy with that, you know.
It's a lot of money. I mean, as I say, just shy of €20,000. Can I ask you about Ronan?
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
Tell me about a little bit about him.
Well, Ronan, he was an advanced paramedic with the ambulance service. He loved his job. He loved looking after people, and he was all into that. And 2019, he was diagnosed with a brain tumour, and that was April 2019. And yeah, he had surgery, treatment, and everything, but unfortunately, it didn't work out for Ronan, yeah. You know. So yeah.
Can I ask you how old he was?
He was 52.
Okay, desperately young. And you have you've got Ross there, who's 17 today.
Yeah.
That's a big day for you, given that Ronan passed away so recently.
Yeah. We were all very close, you know what I mean, Ross and his dad and everything, of course. It is. But sure, like, what do you do? You just have to do what you have to do, I guess, and try and manage to keep going forward.
No,
you know?
I appreciate that. Yeah. And do you work as well, Bree? Do you mind me asking that?
Yeah, I work. I'm a special needs assistant in a local school in Keelogues in Inver. So I'm very happy there, and I've got a great gang of people around me. So it's okay. It's good.
What a gorgeous giving family you are. When you think of Ronan and the ambulance service and you as an SNA, and then look at the next generation coming up the line, Ross just raising nearly €20,000. You know, if you're wondering about Ronan's legacy, look at Ross. Look at the kindness.
Yeah, I guess. You know, there's a lot of Ronan and Ross. I can definitely see that every day. Yeah. So, yeah.
I believe it. I believe it.
That's Bree Keeney in Donegal Town talking to Ryan Tuberty this morning about her son Ross's fundraising for the Irish Cancer Society, which has so far raised over €20,000. If you'd like to donate, just to wish Ross a happy birthday, search Ross's Fundraiser for Irish Cancer Society on Facebook. Meanwhile, on Today with Clare Byrne, Cillian McLaughlin, also known as the Bear Man of Buncrana, founder of Wild Ireland, a sanctuary for animals who roamed the country thousands of years ago, such as bears, wolves and even reindeer, spoke to Clare Byrne this morning.
It was last October, wasn't it, when we last had a chat? And tragically, at that time, one of your bears, Ornia, had died. Of course, we'd no idea what was in store for you and for Wild Ireland over the next few months. How have you all been coping there?
Absolutely. I mean, who could have predicted this? I mean, we're just about surviving, you know, really very much in survival mode. The good news is the animals are thriving. They're blissfully unaware of what is going on in the world. They're thriving in their new homes in the forest. And we're just concentrating on us, the people that look after them, staying healthy and being in a position to continue to provide that care for them here at Wild Ireland.
And how are you managing to feed them all?
It's not easy. There's zero income from the gates. I'm a solicitor and I have some other business interests as well that I'm just literally channeling money to looking after the animals now. The licensing authority in Ireland that allow people to open to the public that have animals are, you know, it's a very high standards, and one of their conditions before they grant the license is that you have a contingency plan that should anything happen to me, this was all pre-pandemic, bear in mind, what would happen to the animals. So in other words, if I wasn't around to look after them, where would they go? And I remember typing up my contingency plan and thinking this will never happen, but who knew we'd be falling back on it so soon. So that involved me, you know, it's a very valuable thing to do, to think about that circumstance, that situation, and where the finances would come from, and should the finances not materialize, where would the animals go after that? And that would have involved maybe rehoming them to other sanctuaries or other wildlife parks. But of course, as we've seen in the news with Dublin Zoo, Fota Wildlife Park, Wild Ireland, all these places are now in the same boat.
And, yes, they all have their similar problems.
Exactly. So where do these animals go if we have to close the doors for good? I can tell you that these animals have become part of my family and my wife's family, and I think we would sell our house before we would let anything happen to them, or before we would we'd give up. So as I said at the start, we're just in survival mode now, and holding our breath, anxiously waiting for the word that we can reopen the gates.
Yeah, because you wouldn't have had a very long period where you had visitors allowed in. As I say, you only opened in October and then you had the shutdown in March, open for a couple of months, then closed again. Do you think the animals would cope very well now with an influx of visitors over the summer?
The animals at Wild Ireland are really unique. They love the interaction from the guests. We do talks and we do public feeding, and the animals love seeing the public, particularly the wolves. They're very interactive. They love watching what the people are doing. You'll see the bears as people approach the viewing platforms to look into the bear habitat. You'll see the bears cocking their noses up in the air to smell who's there, and I'm sure they can smell what people have had for their breakfast off their clothes and stuff. So they definitely do get the interaction from the public, and that's all part of their environmental enrichment that keeps them stimulated. So, you know, I think they miss them, to be honest.
Do you? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I mean, you mentioned there, you know, what would happen if you had to close. You're not close to that point, are you?
Thankfully not at the moment, no, but that's because I'm working in the background and keeping the doors open myself. And, you know, a lot of people have been very generous as well. And we've had donations of food and things like that. And I thank everybody that has done that. But look, it's one of those things that, you know, we all feel as if we've become experts in COVID-19 over the last couple of months. We were bombarded with it on the radio and the media. But we're not. And we have to bear in mind that this is about public health, particularly listening to your last guest there. We realise how serious it is. You had a lady on the show last week, Claire, that I think she was a lecturer in UCD, and she was talking about, you know, how safe being outdoors is.
And that's Orla Hegarty, the architect. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, people are outdoors. They are mixing. They're mixing in gardens. They're mixing in parks. And I would argue that somewhere like Wild Ireland or other parks and wildlife parks outdoors can be supervised, and we can ensure that people are sticking to the rules. And people aren't, you know, there are some people that are acting very silly and taking risks, and I'm sure that's contributing to the stubbornly high numbers that we have. But the majority of people now, I think, understand how COVID spreads, they understand what the rules are. So I would argue that we would have a very safe environment, that if we are allowed to open, and I hope we're allowed to open, we opened last summer, and as did lots of outdoor attractions. And I know Falch Ireland in particular are very proud of the fact that there wasn't any outbreaks last summer that could be correlated to the opening of the various attractions up and down the country.
Killian McLaughlin, also known as the Bear Man of Buncrana, founder of Wild Ireland, talking to Claire Byrne this morning. Ray Darcy read an article in The Guardian which resonated with him, and he wanted to share it with us.
I've been thinking about this for an awful long time, and I've been wondering how to articulate it. And then I opened up The Guardian this morning, and there's an article by Lucy Folks, and the heading is the way we talk about mental health hurting us? Now, I'll begin by saying that I've been saying, sort of half-joke and whole in earnest, to people recently that if I was diagnosed, or I could have been diagnosed as a child, has been suffering from anxiety. I was a worrier. You know, I lost sleep in the lead up to Christmas in case Santa wouldn't arrive. When it came to sporting occasions, like I used to do gymnastics, and I remember hitting the springboard before the vault so hard because I was so tense that I took off. I flew over it instead of what you're supposed to do, put your hands on it and do some sort of jackknife thing. I actually flew over it. I would have been in the medals only for that, because I couldn't control the nerves. So I was an anxious enough child. But that was it. I was just down as a worrier. Now, in this day and age, I may have been diagnosed. I may have been on medication. And that leads us to 10 years ago or so. And I remember we were on the radio and we started talking about depression and we started talking about mental health. And I remember people sending us in emails and going, I'm delighted you're talking about this. This is the last taboo issue in this country, and we talked to people who'd lost loved ones to suicide, and the conversation started. And then I fronted a documentary for TV3 at the time on depression and our mental health services. And I remember where I was in Roscommon Town, I think. It was in Roscommon Town, and I was doing a piece to camera. I was saying, we need to start a conversation. We need to destigmatise mental health, and we need to start talking about it. Well, that happened. And there's any amount of talk on mental health, and most of it's good, but there's a downside, I feel, and Lucy Folks touches on it in her article today in The Guardian. It's well worth a read if you can get your hands on it. And it is that all the language that would have been the preserve of students of psychology and psychiatry and books dealing with that are now available to everybody. You know, anxiety, suffering from anxiety. You would have been anxious, you would have worried a bit, but suffering from anxiety. Depression, you might have had a low mood, but now people are depressed. And those words are now available. And she asked the question in the article, is that a good thing? Is that a good thing? Is somebody who's suffering a little bit of low mood, as opposed to being clinically depressed, if they decide, because they're listening to all this chatter going on around them, that they're depressed, is that a good thing? Probably isn't. Because then it's a spiral down, isn't it? Oh, I'm depressed. I'm depressed about being depressed. And there's this, like, read it yourself if you can get your hands on it. But she says, we need to recalibrate. First, we need to tell more stories about individuals with severe and debilitating mental disorders so we clearly understand what these disorders involve and what can help. Second, we need to promote the idea that a great number of distressing psychological experiences can be managed, sometimes with professional help, without needing to reach for the psychiatric dictionary. And when you listen to, we spoke to the amazing Karen Leach yesterday, and her life and what she's been through and in and out of hospital and having real suicidal ideation because of been sexually abused as a child by Derry O'Rourke. That's the real thing. And you see, what we lose sight of, and this is one of the things I took from studying psychology all those years ago, is that we're on a continuum in everything. You know what I mean? We're on a continuum. So say, take depression, for example. We're on a continuum from, you know, very little, low moods the odd time, to somebody who suffers with chronic depression. And the problem is that everybody is using the same word for that continuum now. Do we need to develop new words? What she says is brilliant, that we need to hear from people who are really, really suffering. And it might give the rest of us perspective. And it might make us think, stop and think before we say, oh, suffering from anxiety, suffering from depression, you know, suicidal. It might make us stop and think, are we really? Is this a fleeting thought? Because, you know, thoughts and feelings aren't facts. They're fleeting. They're in our head and then they move on. Or is it something real that we need treatment for, something real that we need to talk to somebody and seek out psychological or psychiatric help? Now, that doesn't get away from the fact that if you're feeling a little bit down, you do talk to people. That's important. That's hugely important. But it's the language around and the words we use to describe how we're feeling. Lucy Foulkes, F-O-U-L-K-E-S. And it's in the Guardian today. It's well worth a read.
Ray D'Arcy on an article on mental health by Lucy Foulkes in The Guardian. Author Ronan Heshen's debut novel, Leonard and Hungry Paul, has been named as this year's Dublin One City, One Book book. Ronan spoke to Ryan Tuberty this morning.
I'd love you to do me a favour and give us the rundown of Leonard and Hungry Paul, the synopsis, if you will, so that we can lift off and take our chat from there.
Sure. Well, Leonard and Hungry Paul is a book about gentle people. It's about Leonard, who lives with his mother. He's a man in his early 30s, quite a quiet person. He's a ghostwriter of children's encyclopedias. And early on in the book, so I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, his mother passes away, and that sets off a chain reaction where he has to start really engaging with the world and trying to figure out a way of going out into life without becoming overwhelmed by it. And central to the story is his friendship with his friend Hungry Paul, who's a very sort of self-contained, sort of curious sort of individual who nevertheless has very sort of everyday wisdom about how he lives his life. And the book really centres around their relationship and a sort of family story built around it.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from.
I'm from Dublin. I'm 45. I'm married, two kids. I'm a civil servant by day. And I spent all my life in Dublin. I grew up in Beaumont. My father was a postman. My mother was a hospital cleaner. So I didn't have a particularly literary background. But I think my main background then is I went into music. For the last 20 years or so, I was very involved in the music scene before getting into writing, writing Leonard and Hungry Paul.
You were very young when your father passed away.
Yeah, I was seven. So he died in 1983. So So I was seven at the time. I was one of eight children. So my youngest brother was five. My eldest brother was 19 at the time. So that was a very sort of disruptive part of my life. But I should say that, you know, I think the younger kids were largely protected by it, I think, by my mother and my older brothers and sisters. Mm. So I think to some extent we were sort of cushioned from the effect of it. But the effects play out throughout your life, I think.
He was a postman. Can I ask you how he died?
He died of a heart attack.
Okay.
So he just died that night unexpectedly.
I understand. And that was left then to your mother to run the show, as it were.
Yeah, well, she was a housewife, a stay-at-home mother at the time of the eight children. So it was a very big change in her life. So she started work. She worked as a cleaner at Chirswick Nights in Jervis Street Hospital, which is now the Jervis Shopping Centre in Dublin, and then out to Beaumont. But yeah, she held everything together, and my older brothers as well, who would have been just coming into the working world at that stage.
And I noticed in your book that there is a lot of value placed on kindness and friendship, but also a sense that the introvert has feelings too.
Oh, absolutely. I think the book is really a celebration of quiet and introverted people and kind people, you know, the kind of people who don't often feature prominently, I think, in fiction, because perhaps people are used to stories that are built around drama and conflict. So quieter people tend not to get a focus. And, you know, from an early stage in my life, I've seen how important kind people are. A lot of kindness, I think, is expressed in private. So it's probably overlooked or underestimated. But just as you see, listening to Ronan and Breach there on your show before I came on, they're exactly the kind of people who sort of inspired me throughout my life. And, you know, the people I kind of wanted to pay tribute to really in the book.
You know, a teacher was on to us, Ronan, not too long ago, saying that in a class of 30, he was always fascinated by the mid-table students, the person who would come 14th out of 30 or 15th out of 30, perfectly adjusted, smart people, but who were at neither end, if you like, of the spectrum, be it personality-wise or education-wise. And he was intrigued by this mid-table bunch of people, but even calling them mid-table to me feels pejorative. But is this the type of thing you're talking about?
I think the people who interested me, I think, are the kind of people you could easily overlook in life. They don't particularly stand out. They're not particularly pushy. They're not particularly quiet people. Like, we know what loud people think because they tell us. And perhaps the world is the way it is because those people are quite prominent. So I became quite interested in, well, what do the people we're not listening to, what do they have to say? How do I understand these people? And of course, I have elements of it in myself. And once you become aware of it, you see it everywhere. And I began to understand a bit more about how they work. And what occurred to me was, the more I see it in society, what kind people do is they just find something small they can do, and they offer it to other people. Like, there was, when I was writing the book, I remember seeing a story on the news about, you know, the homeless people congregate at the GPO to get various homelessness services.
Yes.
And there was a man who would go down there, he was a dental technician. And what he would do is he'd take the impression of the gums of anyone who needed dental help and come back a week later with dentures for them. So there's an example of somebody who doesn't have the answer to the homelessness problem. He doesn't necessarily want to make a political point about it. But there's something he can do that other people can't, and he offers it to other people. And that's what kind people do.
Yeah. Why are we so taken by that notion that you wanted to write and make it such an essential part of your book, kindness?
I think, you know, at a time when so much is changing, it's really easy to overlook what's not changing. And what sort of holds everything together. And when I started to think about what are the things that never go away, what are the things that are always prominent, what are the things that throughout the ages have been sort of emphasized as important parts of the individual or holding a society together, and what does my own experience tell me of that? And I began to see kindness is actually really important. I think sometimes people think that perhaps it's an easy word to say and that it's perhaps seen as a feel-good concept, but it's actually a practice. You know, it's not just an idea. It's a thing people do. It's a practical thing that people do. And interest. I think the one thing I noticed about kind people actually is they're always in denial about it. If you say to them, "Aren't you very kind to do that?" They'll always say, "Sure, what else would I do?" You know, it hardly occurs to them. It's just so innate, and they don't really think that it's anything special. But if you receive it, you see it's valued.
There's part of your story peppered throughout the book. In you know, Hungry Paul is an occasional postman. Leonard is, well, he's actually, I love his job as a ghostwriter for Children's Encyclopedia. That's just a beautifully bonkers job description.
Yeah, well, I suppose, I think, to be honest with you, the whole book, probably the style of it comes largely from having spent 10 years reading children's books with my kids. And I think sometimes the friendship is sort of that sort of style. And when I sat down to bash out the book, and bear in mind, you know, when you sit down to write your debut book on a laptop on your kitchen table, you don't think you're going to be talking to Ryan Tuberty about it in 3 years' time. So you're just using what's around you. And I'm surrounded by board games, surrounded by children's encyclopedias. And one thing about children's books is you reread them a lot. So over time, you notice, actually, whoever writes this is pretty good. Look at the way they've done it. Look how creative it is. And yet they're nowhere. So I thought it was a good occupational choice for a character who's kind of more of a background character, but nevertheless someone of value.
Yeah, no, I love that. They play Yahtzee, they watch University Challenge. How would you describe them, the two lads? I mean, have they stunted growth emotionally, or are they just dancing to their own beat? How would you describe them?
I wouldn't describe them as in any way sort of deficient or in any way people who have shortcomings. Mm-hmm. I think they are people who are self-taught. I think they're self-taught, not just in terms of their curiosities, but also their emotional lives. So they tried to figure out the world on their own. They haven't been guided. And so the answers they come up with are a little idiosyncratic. But I do think they're sincere and they're pure. And I think one thing that happens with Hungry Paul, who's a really sort of different type of character in the book, is I think throughout the book, each of the characters goes through change. I think with Hungry Paul, perhaps the reader goes through the change. Mm. You know, if you said to somebody, "I want you to meet this guy. You're looking for a boyfriend. I want you to meet this guy. He's early 30s, lives with his parents, and only works one day a week." Most people would say, "You know what? You're okay. I think I know who you're talking about." And it's about the way we can sometimes underestimate people from a distance or from appearances, but actually we find out he's a person of great self-awareness.
That's author Ronan Heshin talking to Ryan Tuberty about his novel Leonard and Hungry Paul, which is this year's Dublin One City One Book. Ireland's vaccine rollout has been frustratingly slow so far, especially when compared to our nearest neighbour. So when the government announces that the rollout will significantly ramp up in April, we should all be pretty excited, right? Not so fast, say a wide array of medical professionals who spoke to Today with Claire Byrne reporter Barry Lenehan.
This is, they say, a gargantuan operation, Claire, involving pharmacies, GP clinics, new technologies, those mass vaccination clinics, a lot of moving parts. And as the man charged with overseeing the task, the HSE's David Walsh told the Sunday Business Post this month, "When you push your finger on the switch, will the light go on?" So real concerns over the health system's ability to keep up with vaccine supply, deliver 250,000 jabs a week when vaccines really start arriving in 2 weeks' time. Now, earlier this month, you might recall, I brought you doubts over whether we'll have enough vaccinators, Claire. Those doubts, well, they're growing since. The HSE has now extended the closing date for vaccinator applications to work in those mass vaccination clinics for a third time to April 7th. Initially, it was March 2nd. Pay is too low for some. Others say there's not enough flexibility for those wishing to work part-time or for free. And others say that the application process is needlessly onerous and bureaucratic.
And we've heard some of those stories on the programme. And I see the front of the Irish Examiner today reporting how a former surgeon was asked for her birth cert and her junior cert results when she tried to become a vaccinator.
Yeah, part of a list of 14 requirements for some looking to apply. And GPs have also complained that they're being sent for vaccinator trainings when they want to work in these centres, even though they're delivering a vaccine clinic in their own surgery and had to do training for that. Radiographers and phlebotomists still excluded from becoming vaccinators. However, the HSE has done a U-turn on one issue I brought you previously, allowing those over 70 to become vaccinators. You'll recall Dr. Paul Moriarty, the former medical director of the Eye and Ear Hospital in Dublin. He says guidance has been changed to allow those over 70 become vaccinators once they've received the jab themselves. Now, the HSC has said it needs up to 2,600 vaccinators across the clinics. The latest figures show how 4,000 people have applied, but just 500 have signed contracts thus far.
That's an interesting disparity. So it seems the will and the interest is there, but they're not managing to convert them into people who are fully signed up then to do the job.
Correct, yes.
So what about pharmacies and pharmacists?
Community pharmacists are due to administer 50,000 jabs when we hit this 250,000 target. But pharmacists claim they're in the dark. And unless urgent clarity is provided by the Health Minister and the HSE, then vaccination targets for pharmacies will be missed. Dara O'Loughlin is the General Secretary of the Irish Pharmacy Union.
Pharmacists are trained, they're getting their pharmacies ready. They really want to be engaged, they want to start vaccinating their patients and their local communities, but we don't know yet when we can start. We haven't got the official go-ahead. We don't have any visibility at this stage on when vaccines will be delivered to us, what quantities will be delivered, which cohorts we're going to be vaccinating. There are a lot of details that still have to be released by the HSE. And at this stage, I can't tell you exactly when pharmacists will start vaccinating or which group will be vaccinating first.
The HSE might argue we can't tell you until we get the supply.
I would say we shouldn't have to wait until we have vaccines in a warehouse before we publish a plan for how we're going to use them. If we really want pharmacists to get on the pitch and start vaccinating as soon as the vaccines arrive, we need to give them plenty of notice so they can organise their staffing schedules and their premises around that and be ready for when the vaccines are delivered.
Not all pharmacists are yet vaccinated themselves.
There are patches of the country where pharmacists haven't yet been vaccinated, despite being prioritised for vaccination as health workers. And large numbers of pharmacy staff and pharmacy team members around the country who will be instrumental in the vaccination campaign through pharmacies are still waiting for appointments for their own vaccination. Every week that we delay in these details is a week when pharmacists don't do 50,000 vaccinations. If we don't put plans in place and we don't distribute the vaccines as soon as they arrive, then there is a risk that targets will be missed. And that's something none of us want to see.
Now, the HSC this morning points to comments made last week by HSC CEO Paul Reid that pharmacies probably won't have a role in vaccine rollout in April, and pharmacists, they're still largely remaining clear of those mass vaccination centres as they claim the rate of pay to work there is around a third of what was agreed.
Barry, you've also been hearing concerns about the technology, because people will remember the Beacon controversy. The background to that was that healthcare staff were double booked for vaccine appointments. Now, what plans are in train to fix that?
So we have a new vaccine registration portal for the general public. This has been developed by IBM and Salesforce. People go in, they receive a vaccine appointment when their cohort is up. Now, the HSC says this will go live in the coming weeks. It was promised for early April. It also says work has been undertaken to ensure double appointments don't happen again, like what happened last week. No word yet, though, on when the majority of people will be vaccinated beyond those at high risk in cohort 4.
And then going back to what we were saying about flicking the switch, will the lights come on? The GPs have a significant role to play in this. They've already been rolling out vaccines, we know, but they're going to have to up the ante considerably as well. There's a huge expectation there.
Yeah, 100,000 jabs a week is the expectation. And we are expecting details of a deal between the Irish Medical Organisation and the HSE, which will see the GPs on board to vaccinate those aged 16 to 69 at very high risk. Those details expected later today. However, GPs I spoke to in several corners of the country, they claim this 100,000 target is unachievable. Some are questioning their continued participation in the rollout even due to the increasing impact on non-COVID patient care. GPs also claim the identification of high-risk patients by hospitals is haphazard due to IT failings, and they're inundated with calls from people who think it's their turn for the jab. Now, Dr. Peter Sloan, we've heard him on the programme before, a GP in Carraroe in Galway. Does he think targets will be met?
Unfortunately, I find it very difficult to be confident based on my experience to date. What I'm hearing at the minute now is that when they've moved down to the under 70s with the AstraZeneca vaccine, the first cohort, the so-called 4A cohort, the very, very highest risk medical patients under 69 are, you know, being called from the hospital, but not in a very organised fashion. I'm aware of patients of mine, some of whom have been called that have much lower risk than others. Really, I think the genie is out of the bottle in terms of being able to have a coordinated, organised response. But now the genie is gone. So I'm in a position where I really don't know anymore which of my patients under 70 have so far been vaccinated, which haven't.
So what you're saying is you're ringing people up who've been vaccinated already?
We're being told by people that they have had their vaccines, either through, you know, charity services, the people who are being called to the hospital, you know, on biologics. But it seems to me, anecdotally, from what I've heard from my patients, that there is not much logical organisation at a hospital level. You'll have the dermatology clinic calling their cohort of patients that they regard as high risk. My rheumatology patients on biological agents have not been called. They would, in my view, some of them would be higher risk. I've had other people who are not high risk diabetics being called by the diabetic centre. Each department is calling who they perceive to be highest risk patients, but at a global population level, that really doesn't add up to have a coordinated rollout on a risk basis.
Do you think some GPs may call it stumps here in relation to the vaccine rollout, that the administrative burden from here on in is too much?
I don't think that would be a determining factor, but there has to be recognition, I feel, very strongly from the HSE, that administratively dealing with COVID-19 vaccinations is not like any other vaccination programme. It's not like the flu vaccination. There is a substantive administrative burden involved. I just give you a very simple example. We received a delivery this morning of 60 COVID-19 vaccines, which we're running a vaccine clinic tomorrow. That's 60 patients that have to be phoned this afternoon, have to have an appointment time given to them. That's the phone off for the afternoon. We're now out of practice for half a day tomorrow to do those vaccinations. So it has a significant impingement in many ways on practice, and I don't think that there was adequate recognition given to that by the HSE, or even perhaps a real appreciation from a GP perspective at negotiation level of the burden that was involved.
250,000 vaccines administered a week, that's the plan. Do you think that the infrastructure is there to keep a pace with vaccine supplies and deliver that target?
I would hope they'll be able to deliver what they say they're going to deliver, but there would need to be some more pragmatism applied. I'll believe it when I see it. I'll believe 250,000 a week whenever somebody produces me a figure that says that's what was vaccinated in the meantime. I would hope that they focus on crafting a deal that allows me to be able to get on with vaccinating my patients, and the same for many of my colleagues over the country.
Dr. Peter Sloan talking about Ireland's vaccine rollout with Today with Clare Byrne reporter Barry Lenehan. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.